2 Samuel chapter 7, the book of Acts chapter 2. I'm not going to go back over the individual covenants every time we meet together. We've done that at least 2 Sundays in a row. But I will rename them briefly just to remind you of what we were speaking. If you recall, there's the Adamic covenant, then the Edenic covenant, the Noahic covenant, the Abrahamic. Last Lord's Day, we talked about the Mosaic. And today, we're going to talk about the Palestinian and the Davidic. If you're already in 2 Samuel chapter 7, and then Acts chapter 2, turn also to Deuteronomy chapter 30. Deuteronomy chapter 30. And one other place, if you've got a full finger, Joshua chapter 21. Joshua chapter 21. When we build the new pulpit, God willing, I'm going to have a whole sphere of places to put books. I told Judy I wanted to build a little extension out on the front pew. We had a desk and a place to study, and she said, no, that would look tacky. So, but I don't know why a pastor shouldn't be able to study right up to the minute he preaches. Since we might have a piano with an extended body, could I get a chair and pull right up there? And okay, remember the Adamic covenant was God's prohibition to Adam and Eve not to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. Therefore, it was a conditional covenant contingent upon their obeying its terms. Unlike the second covenant, which was the Edenic covenant, an unconditional covenant where God said, I will, period. Not contingent upon what man did, but guaranteed by what God pledged. Then the Noahic covenant of Genesis chapter 6. Again, a covenant still in force, for it is introductory to the dispensation of human government, though some people would argue that it's not still in force. At least we do have governments instituted by God. Then fourthly, the Abrahamic covenant, which I think is the most important covenant to understand in relation to prophecy. Who is the seed of Abraham being the essential question. Then fifthly, the Mosaic covenant. If you remember last week, we talked about the law of Moses in its moral, thou shalt not, penal, the punishments for breaking the law, and ceremonial aspects, the tabernacle, priesthood, and offering, and how the book of Hebrews addressed each aspect of that Mosaic covenant. Christ fulfilling the ceremonial aspects of the law. And actually, He fulfilled the moral and penal aspects of the law, satisfying the moral demands of the law to the infinite degree of their standard, and satisfying the penal aspects of the law for the elect. And this is, as an aside, one reason I argue against people who believe in a general atonement. The doctrine of justification, I felt like buckwheat there for a moment, the doctrine of justification. Okay, erase that out of your mind. I'm trying to make a theological point here. The doctrine of justification means the satisfaction of the law. And if the blood of Christ satisfied the demands of the law for all humanity, I believe all humanity will be saved. But Romans 8:33 says, who shall lay anything to the charge of God's what? Elect. It is God who justified. Romans 8:29, whom he foreknew, he also predestinated. Whom he predestinated, then he also called. Whom he called, then he also justified. So Christ fulfills the Mosaic law. Now we come this morning to the Palestinian covenant. We find that in Deuteronomy chapter 30, beginning with verse 1. Mike Doyle, would you read verses 1 through 3, please, sir? Okay, now, you know the history of the Old Testament. Genesis, Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, and then lastly, Deuteronomy, the book of laws. Now, this is the last thing that Moses ever writes and says to the children of Israel, this book, Deuteronomy, and thereafter is Joshua, then the conquest of Canaan, then the time of the judges. Now, if you'll note in verses 1 through 3, God is telling Israel that He will bless her with an occupation of the land of Palestine. Okay? Certainly, we all understand biblical history to greater and lesser degrees. But here is a quick graph. You have Israel in Egypt, and their destiny is Canaan. What brings Israel out of Egypt to Canaan is the Exodus. The leader of the Exodus is Moses, who brings them from Egypt through the wilderness of sin to Canaan. And then if you remember, just as they got to the land of Canaan, God allowed Moses to ascend a mountain and look over into Canaan, but not to enter in himself, because he had disobeyed God by smiting as opposed to speaking to the rock. Then, who is the leader? Joshua. And you recall Joshua, in the book Joshua, leads Israel into Canaan land, what we call Palestine and Israel, and during the reign of Joshua and the judges, Israel begins to subdue her enemies. Now for prophecy, this is one of the hot points of debate. The debate being that in the Palestinian covenant, Deuteronomy chapter 30, verses 1, 2, 3, and other passages in the book Deuteronomy and Numbers especially, that God has promised Israel this land. Therefore, we call it the Promised Land. But the dispensationalist argument is that Israel has never fully occupied the Promised Land, and that therefore there remains an occupation. Now, in the dispensational scheme of things, if you remember, you have this timeline followed by the rapture, and you have this huge war, actually that lasts for 3.5 years, the last 3.5 years of the tribulation. And then you have the second coming, and then a 1,000-year period during which Jesus reigns upon a physical throne, the throne of David that we're going to talk about in a moment, in the physical Jerusalem, in the physical Canaan. And that this is in fulfillment of the Palestinian covenant. In my opinion, there are three verses of Scripture that argue so forcibly against this view. And remember, the presupposition of the view is that Israel never thoroughly inhabited Palestine. I rest my case. First of all, we can't speak about this in a vacuum. I don't think that Israel is who dispensationalists say Israel is. So it's hard for me to even argue with them on common ground, because when you can't agree who Israel is, nor can I agree with them what Jerusalem is. They understand Jerusalem one way, I understand it a completely different way. So if you can't even agree about the terms of your argument, then how in the world can you dialogue? And that is one of the things that makes dialogue so difficult. Well, look at Joshua. Dispensationalists argue that Joshua will never successfully completed his campaign of conquest. Now, we know that there are pockets of resistance in territorial Palestine forever. David and Solomon come the closest to a complete conquest. But in Joshua 21, I believe that you have a divinely inspired record that says what God promised to Israel about the land, He fulfilled in the days of Joshua. Again, dispensationalists say, no, the Palestinian covenant has never fully been fulfilled. It is yet to be fulfilled in its ultimate sense. Well, I rest my case in Joshua chapter 21, verses 43 through 45. And Grady Cook, would you read those verses for us, please, sir? Joshua 21, 43 through 45.
So Jehovah gave Israel all the land which he had sworn to give to their fathers, and they possessed it and lived in it. And Jehovah gave them rest on every side according to all that he had sworn to their fathers, and no one of all their enemies stood before them. Jehovah gave all their enemies into their hands. Not one of the
Okay. Now, if you look at basically two words. First of all, the word all. And then secondly, the word, actually the phrase that Grady read, not one. Or in my translation, it says not ought or not anything. In verse 43, the Lord gave unto Israel all the land. Verse 44, according to all that he sware unto their fathers. There stood not a man of all their enemies. Yahweh delivered all their enemies into their hand. In verse 45, there fell not aught, not one word, which Yahweh had spoken unto the house of Israel. All came to pass. Now that's an argument. It's a scriptural argument. And a well-studied dispensationalist would have a response to that. But I reiterate, that's where I rest my case, that the terms in their fullest sense of the Palestinian covenant were fulfilled in the days of Joshua. Now, again, I reiterate, I can't make that conviction in itself, apart from what I said last week about what the covenant of Moses meant, what the tabernacle meant, what the priesthood meant, what the sacrifices meant. And I would also continue to remind you about Hebrews chapter 12 or Galatians chapter 3 and 4, where Paul speaks of the Jerusalem which is above. The Jerusalem which is above, or as he calls it, the heavenly Jerusalem. Zion, which was a physical mountain near Jerusalem, is also spoken of as the heavenly dwelling place of the people of God. When I say heavenly, I don't mean in the ultimate sense of heaven, but I mean in the immediate sense of where we sit, quote, in heavenly places in Christ. Now, comments or questions before I move on briefly and talk about the Davidic covenant? Well, the text, Grady, is very emphatic about that. So that's where I would rest my case. I think that if you talk about virtual control versus absolute control, I think there's a distinction there in the history of Israel. She didn't have absolute control territorially of everything, because she had to fight little battles all the way through. You read the bloody book of Judges, up until the time, really, of David. But she had virtual control. And what I'm saying is that this passage in Joshua says, from God's perspective, we accept that this is inspired, he said, I completed all the promises to you. Anybody else have a question or comment? That's what I would say. And I think the response of the dispensationalists would be, well, but the physical yet has aspects to be fulfilled in the millennium of Christ. And once you physicalize the land in the future, then, and this is an argument that I made last week, you got to take everything. You can't just say the land. You can't just say the throne of David. You can't just say the city of Jerusalem. You have to say the tabernacle. You have to say the priesthood. You have to say the offerings. You have to say the political superiority of Israel over the nations, and so forth. But yeah, I think that's the argument. That would be my argument from my position, that it had its physical fulfillment in the past, and now the highest spiritual fulfillment is in force and will be for all eternity. In Ezekiel? Oh, in 48? In my opinion, it means nothing. Not in the prophetic sense. And I was referring, Grady, there to Ezekiel 37. I heard a dispensationalist theologian a couple of weeks ago talk about Ezekiel 37. If you remember, Ezekiel prophesies to the bones, and bone comes to bone, muscle comes to bone, flesh comes upon muscle and bone, and they're dead. They're a body, but they're dead. And he was drawing a parallel between that image in Ezekiel of bone coming to bone, muscle coming to bone, flesh coming to muscle and bone, to the regathering of Israel unto the physical Palestine during and immediately after 1948. His point was that Israel now is a valley of dry bones, corporally uniting, bone coming to bone, flesh coming to flesh, etc., but waiting for life. Waiting for life, which would be the rebirth of the nation, which will occur, Grady, right here, according to dispensationalists. Israel will go through here, be tricked by the Antichrist in 3.5 years, will be persecuted by him, and Christ will step in the last moment to save her at the Battle of Armageddon. Interestingly, in Ezekiel, there's a major problem I have never heard any dispensationalist address. Major, huge problem I have never heard any dispensationalist address. In Ezekiel 37, where you have the Valley of Dry Bones live, the war that follows in Ezekiel 38 is Gog and Magog, not Armageddon. And the building of the temple is after that. Okay? In Revelation, the battle of Armageddon immediately follows the rebirth of the nation of Israel, not the battle of Gog and Magog. And there's a 1,000-year discrepancy in between Revelation and Ezekiel between the battle of Armageddon, which is not mentioned in Ezekiel, and the battle of Gog and Magog. So to me, there's a huge chronological problem for dispensationalists here, which I have never heard a single one address. Is that confusing? Do you understand what I'm saying? Do I need to explain it in a few more words? Let me restate it.
In other words, the battle of Gog and Magog, you know, those two separate conflicts.
Okay. In Ezekiel 37, the battle of Gog and Magog is in the immediate context of the rebirth of the nation. But not in Revelation. In Revelation, the battle of Armageddon is in the immediate context of the rebirth of the nation. And if we follow the chronology of Ezekiel, then you'd have the battle of Gog and Magog followed by the 1,000 years. But if you follow the chronology of Revelation... Am I saying Revelation and Ezekiel are incongruent? Yes. Chronologically. And let me, I don't want to disturb you by saying that. I don't believe those books have anything to do with time. But to me, the chronology of Revelation and Ezekiel is irrelevant. But if you want to interpret them in a physical sense, then chronology is relevant. And what I'm saying, if you try to interpret them in a physical sense, you're on the horns of a dilemma. Because Gog and Magog occurs in the context of the rebirth of the nation in Ezekiel. Armageddon occurs in the context of the rebirth of the nation in Revelation. And Gog and Magog does not come to 1,000 years later. Gog and Magog 1,000 years before the end of the millennium in Ezekiel. Gog and Magog 1,000 years after. Now, some people would take me to task on saying there's incongruence here chronologically. Okay. I'm simply saying the latter chapters in Ezekiel and all the book of Revelation are not chronological records, that's all. And so it doesn't bother me if there's apparent chronological incongruence. Because I think the books are symbolic. I think there's a tremendous problem for those who would argue for the chronological interpretations of the book because of this huge discrepancy between Ezekiel and Revelation. Bobby?
Brought out basically what I was going to say in regards to hermeneutically, dispensationalists would seem they pick and choose spiritualizing text instead of taking it literally, as the text would show to take it figuratively. They blame amillennialists for spiritualizing more than nature.
Right. Bobby's making an excellent point there. The word hermeneutic is from the Greek word hermeneuo, which means to interpret. And my approach to interpreting Revelation is radically different to dispensationalists or premillennialists or postmillennialists, for that matter. Because here's what they all say. This is in the front of Dr. Whitelaw's book. You must interpret the prophecy literally, as the prophet understood it. And therefore, when a dispensationalist gets to Revelation 20 and it says 1,000 years, they say this is 1,000 years, chronologically and physically. But Bobby's point is, they don't do that everywhere in Revelation. They only do it where it fits their scheme. For instance, in Revelation chapter 1, when Christ has a sharp sword proceed out of his mouth? That with it he might smite the nations? They don't accept that physically. In the book of Revelation, and I would add in every apocalyptic book, including Zephaniah, Ezekiel, Zechariah, and all the apocalyptic passages in Isaiah, stay with me. Dispensationalism does not have a consistent method of interpretation. This is one of Dr. Whitelaw's points in the book. They pick and choose. They pick and choose when it fits their scheme. If I open the book of Revelation, I will assert that it is a symbolic book, primarily, almost exclusively, with a handful of exceptions. For instance, the seven churches in Revelation 2 and 3. But even the way Christ talks to those churches is symbolic. You permit that woman Jezebel to teach and seduce my prophets, I will cast her into a bed, and those that commit adultery with her. Spiritual implications. So that's a good point, Bobby. Any other questions or comments?
I was listening to a fellow on the radio that claimed that the events of Revelation were chronological, as that the now
Yes, sir. Here, if you want to know the chronology of Revelation according to dispensationalism, here's what it is. Revelation chapter 1, a symbolic view of Christ. Symbolic view of Christ. Revelation chapters 2 and 3, church history. And therefore, the idea that each church is a symbolic representation of a certain time in the history of the church, and we're now the Laodicean church. Revelation 4, the rapture. Revelation 5 through 18, the tribulation. Revelation 19, the second coming. Revelation 20, the millennium. Revelation 21 and 22, the new heaven and the new earth after the millennium. That's the chronology of dispensationalism in Revelation. And my argument is that chronology is irrelevant in all apocalyptic literature. It may have historical value for its teachings. It may indeed have historical and physical roots to its symbols, such as the great whore that sits upon the scarlet beast and the city set on seven hills, which we know is Rome. I'm sure John understood those images as portraying Rome. But how else can you root a symbol except in a temporal, spatial metaphor? All symbols are rooted in temporal and spatial metaphors. Else, the symbol would be something we couldn't grasp. The purpose of symbols always is to tell us something in time and space, to show us something in time and space, and then say, but it means more than that. And remember Paul in Galatians 3 and 4 when he talks about Isaac and Ishmael. He says these things are symbolic. Ishmael is the old Jerusalem. Hagar is the old covenant. Isaac's the new Jerusalem. He's writing to Gentiles. You, brethren, are the seed of Isaac. Your mother is Sarah, who is the heavenly Jerusalem. I'll tell you why this view of Scripture is so hard. Because it contradicts everything in our logical, rational, physical, temporal, spatial minds. And in order for us to see it, we have to transcend logic, space, time, and enter into spiritual realms of understanding. And the only way you can do that is by the Spirit of God. Okay? Paul, how are we doing on time, sir? 10:30. Well, I'm not going to get to the Davidic covenant, but that's okay. Anybody else? Look over at Ezekiel chapter 38. 37. And then look at Revelation 19. I'll show you the passages I'm referring to. Okay? If you look at Revelation 19, okay, you have the second coming of Christ at the battle of Armageddon, according to dispensationalism. To me, this is also absurd. It is absurd. It is absurd. To me, it is an absurd contradiction of the doctrine of the sovereignty of God. To say that Christ would come to earth and reign, but then after 1,000 years, he'd be still having problems. I mean, that blows me away. But here's the problem between Revelation and Ezekiel. In Revelation 19, you have the marriage supper of the Lamb in the air with Christ, according to dispensationalism. And then Christ descends to fight with the Antichrist in order to save national Israel. And that begins in verse 17, when the angels call the fowls of the earth to come eat the flesh, verse 18, of kings, etc., etc. Okay? They're all gathered together unto Armageddon. And Christ conquers Antichrist and his army, saves Israel, and then chapter 20, the devil and his angels are cast into the bottomless pit. Verse 4. Then you have the 1,000 years. Then verse 7. After 1,000 years, Satan is loosed. And he goes out to the four quarters of the earth, Gog and Magog, to gather them together to battle, etc., etc. So here's what happens. Rapture, tribulation, second coming, Battle of Armageddon, 1,000 years, Battle of Gog and Magog. Well, look back at Ezekiel. Every dispensationalist I know, every one, says that Ezekiel chapter 37 happens right after the Battle of Armageddon. That when Jesus comes down from heaven with the church, clothed in a vesture dipped in blood, with the armies of heaven behind him on white horses and white linen, pure and clean, which I think is all symbolic. When he comes down and puts his foot on the Mount of Olives, which I think is symbolic, that at that time he establishes the millennial reign of Christ. And that lasts for 1,000 years. And after 1,000 years, the battle of Gog and Magog. Well, you just saw, that's not what Ezekiel says. Ezekiel says when Christ rebirths Israel in Ezekiel 37, that immediately he'll fight the battle of Gog and Magog. I'm getting on a roll here. I'm going to have to quit. Listen, you remember the passage in Isaiah? Listen carefully. It says, quote, "A nation shall be born in a day," unquote. Remember that passage? Dispensationalists say that's the second coming of Christ when Israel's reborn. I'll tell you when it happened. It happened on the cross. It happened on the cross and in the resurrection of Christ. So I understand Ezekiel 37 to be relative to the whole house of Israel, meaning the spiritual seed of Abraham. But let's come back to my point. In Ezekiel 38, I hope I'm not confusing. I'm going to show you what dispensationalists say about Revelation. Okay? Now, Revelation 19, Christ comes down. This is the battle of Armageddon. And at the battle of Armageddon, the nation of physical Israel is reborn. She reigns and rules with Christ for 1,000 years, after the which is the battle of Gog and Magog. Okay? That's how dispensationalists understand Revelation. Ezekiel, here's what happens. Look, Israel is reborn here according to dispensationalists. Well, in Ezekiel, you have Israel reborn at, but guess what? Battle is the context of her rebirth. Gog and Magog. And that's my point. You have a 1,000 year problem. A 1,000 year problem in your understanding of Ezekiel versus Revelation from a dispensational. Is it solvable? No. Not a solvable problem. Not solvable for me. There's a discrepancy. There's a discrepancy in this sense that if it's physical nations, physical warriors, physical battles, physical time, you can't reconcile it. If it's symbolic language, having to do with our spiritual warfare, enemies of Yahweh, the eternal struggle between the church and evil, then the symbols are less than the realities they represent and very secondary to them. Okay? Questions or comments?